Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio productions from this and many other independent community stations across the country. We bring local stories to a national audience from a different location every week. I'm David Hasseltine of Pacifica affiliate station WHUS FM 91.7 in Storrs, Connecticut.
It did not have to happen that way. The Israeli military could have gained control over their ships in non-violent ways.
In following the policies that we have in attempting to marginalize and isolate groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, we've actually accomplished the opposite. We've isolated and marginalized ourselves.
Today on Sprouts, we'll hear from retired Colonel Anne Wright about her experiences while on board the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Then, Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio interviews journalist Mark Perry about a new Red Team report from the Pentagon that criticizes U.S. and Israeli policy on Gaza and Lebanon. On June 30, 2010, Anne Wright spoke at an event at Real Artways, an artist community in Hartford, Connecticut. Wright was a passenger on one of the ships that were trying to break Israel's blockade of Gaza in May.
The whole idea of the flotilla had nothing to do with Hamas. It had to do with the people of Gaza and the treatment that was happening to them because of this blockade.
The peace activists trying to bring in much-needed aid supplies found themselves becoming part of an international scandal at sea as Israeli commando forces opened fire on board the crowded aid vessel Mavi Marmara, killing 9 people and shooting 50 in all. In 2009, she and members of Code Pink were among the few Americans to visit Gaza after Israeli bombing.
The cargo ships were filled with all sorts of construction materials. We knew that the Israeli military or the Israeli government would say, well, those ships, they're going to be bringing in weapons for Hamas, and that's why we have to stop them at sea. So those 6 ships, and actually 8, 2 more later, all of those ships were inspected by international authorities at the ports from which they left. Because everyone knew that would be the argument the Israeli government would use. So that was one of the key things. We had to have all of those ships inspected very, very closely to make sure that there were no weapons on board, that there was nothing that could be used to say you guys were supporting Hamas. The ships, the ones that I was on, the 2, Challenger 1 and Challenger 2, that were actually purchased by the Free Gaza movement, it took us 24 hours to actually go from Crete to the meeting place, which was off Cyprus. Interestingly enough, both of those boats developed steering problems at virtually the same time, about 12 hours out of Crete. You know, you think, well, how could that happen? And then others say, well, we know how it could happen. I'm not sure how it happened yet, but certainly we have mechanics that are trying to figure out how both of the steering mechanisms failed at virtually the same time. The next 12 hours, the boats were guided by the engines, by 2 engines on each one. So our track across the Mediterranean to get from Crete to Cyprus was one like this. As one engine would kick in, it would go this way, and then the other one would kick in, we'd go that way. So it was kind of herringbone all the way to the meeting point. One of the ships, Challenger 1, then went on to Cyprus to pick up some Cypriot members of parliament, some Irish members of parliament, and other people who had flown into Cyprus to be picked up there. I, in my boat, Challenger 2 at that time, went to the meeting place, and we were invited to come on board the large Mavi Marmara so that we would be on that vessel while the Challenger 2 then went to Crete to try to get the steering mechanism repaired so it could rejoin. So I was able to spend about 48 hours on that big passenger ferry boat. I met a lot of people on that boat. You know, about 400 of the 600 people that were on the boat were from Turkey. Many of them work for an international aid organization called the International Humanitarian Foundation. The abbreviation for it is IHH. It has a tremendous website that I would encourage you all to look at. It's www.ihh.org. And you can see that despite the commentary of the Israeli government and the U.S. government, that this is an organization that has been materially aiding Hamas for years. You can see that it is a large humanitarian organization that has programs all over the world, and that as lots of organizations that do work in Gaza, and there are still some that have patiently tried under the siege and quarantine to still try to do work there, that indeed any organization that's there in some way has contact with the government. There's no way you can get around it. IHH says that it does not in any way support terrorist activities by Hamas, that it has international, it has humanitarian programs for the people of Gaza. On the Marmara, 600 people on that ship, helicopters coming over, percussion grenades going off all through the ship. And then at some point, and this is why an investigation is very, very important, at what point was live ammunition being used? There are reports from an Al Jazeera reporter who was standing up on the top deck near the wheelhouse, near the captain of the ship, that as he was up there and the helicopters were starting to come and starting to, the commandos were rappelling down on ropes onto the upper deck, that the man standing next to him all of a sudden slumped over and blood was coming out of him, that he had been shot from above. If that's true, then one can anticipate that other people that were on that upper deck saw what happened and were not pleased with it. And that may be, and this is why the investigation is important, it may be what precipitated what we saw on that video, where you saw as the commandos started coming down, that there were guys on the upper deck that took sticks, that took railings that they had broken off and started beating those Israeli commandos. That was not part of the nonviolent resistance that they had decided on in the Mavi Marmara. That was not what they had decided to do at all. I'm really interested to know what precipitated what we saw there. What we didn't see was that I think that video lasted about 4 seconds, and we saw a lot of guys pounding on at least 3 of the Israeli commandos. What we didn't see was what followed next, which was the captain of the Mavi Marmara coming out of the wheelhouse, and the director of IHH, the International Humanitarian Organization, coming out to tell the guys in person and then on loudspeakers throughout the ship, stop beating these Israeli commandos. Stop beating them. And then appointing a Turkish doctor that was up on the top, that is a good friend of the director of IHH, who was told, you take these 3 guys, they're in your charge, and don't let anything more happen to them, and take them down to the first aid station that was on the ship. And that doctor did exactly that. And there's an interview of him that's in the New York Times that's very, very interesting, that he was saying that it was difficult to get the guys down the stairway because there were a lot of people on board the ship that had already started seeing other things happen on the ship, and they were mad, they were angry with these 3 Israeli commandos. But the commandos were taken down, they were treated. You've probably seen some pictures of at least one of them whose face was bloody. He was treated. And then all 3 of them were very quickly returned to Israeli control because no one wanted it said that the ship had captured and was holding Israeli commandos. That was something we did not want. And they were returned virtually immediately to the control of the Israeli military. Well, during the next 25 to 30 minutes, though, as the commandos were going through the various levels on the ship, they started using live ammunition. And we now know that 9 people were killed. 5 of them were shot at very close range with bullets through their head. The one American citizen, and this is something the State Department has not publicized and our own media really has not publicized well, there was one of the 9 was an American citizen. He was not a Turkish American, he was an American. He was born from Turkish parents. He lived in the United States till age 2, and then his parents took him to Turkey. But for whatever reason, he never formally applied for Turkish citizenship. He was a resident of Turkey. And not that being an American citizen means you should have any special treatment. 9 deaths are horrible. All 9 deaths are horrible. But our government, the United States government, should make a stink when an American citizen is murdered. The Turkish government has certainly made a very strong stand against eight of its citizens and one of its residents who were murdered, and also the 50 other people that were shot. There were 50 more people that were shot there, many of them very, very seriously. I talked with some of the women who had been a part of the first aid station, the nurses. I mean, the call went out, please, anyone with medical experience, please come to the first aid station. We have serious injuries. And this was being broadcast to the Israeli military, too. Please, if you have, we need your medical help. We have people that are dying right now. We have seriously wounded people. Please help. Please help. The women and men who had medical training went to the first aid station, and some of the nurses who we talked with 24 hours later, as we were all in the Israeli prison together, said that the blood was up to their ankles, that there was so much blood. There's so many people that had been wounded. And ultimately, nine died. Four of them died in the first aid room that they could not, there was nothing they could do for them. Many of the wounded were helicoptered to Israeli hospitals. Not many, I think it was like 15 of them. And four of them had to stay in the hospitals after we departed because they were so seriously injured that the Israeli government said they are unstable, they cannot be moved. The Turkish government had medical people that were there to certify, you know, and to be with them while they were still in the Israeli hospitals. With all six of the ships under control very quickly, and each one of them had had their own type of resistance. On the other passenger ship, the passengers had formed a circle around the wheelhouse and were trying to prevent the commandos from entering the wheelhouse by locking arms, sitting down, and they were pushed away, shoved away. One American citizen, Paul Arudi, who's been on several of the ships, he was pretty well pummeled by the commandos on that ship to the point that he jumped overboard to get away from it. He jumped overboard, and this was like five in the morning, so it was still dark. And of course, that did not endear him to the commandos, so when they fished him out, he got another pummeling, so the story goes. On one of the cargo ships, they had put concertina wire up around the upper part of the ship so it would make it harder for the commandos to go up into that ship. So there were various types of resistance that was going on, but none of them with weapons, although the Israeli military, you probably saw the pictures of some knives that were there. And they, on the very first day, they said, see, here are the weapons. And there was an axe that was there. Well, the axe is a normal complement of every ship. It's what you have to cut lines if there are problems. It was, to my knowledge, it was never used on anyone. There were knives that were there that were in the canteens, the places where the food was being prepared. I did hear one report was that one Israeli soldier had been stabbed. However, there's another report saying that an Israeli soldier, as he was rappelling down off the ropes, ran into one of the poles on the ship and gouged his leg. And that's another thing this investigation needs to be able to tell us. What happened to that young soldier? Was he injured because of a pole that he ran into, or was it because someone stabbed him? And that it's important for us to know, because that the stabbing of anyone was nothing. I would be horrified if that happened. All of the vessels were under control very, very quickly. It did not have to happen that way. The Israeli military could have gained control over their ships in non-violent ways.
Anne Wright took a dissenting position about the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq and resigned in protest of invasion plans she felt were based on lies, an argument that was, of course, later proven correct. Her book about that topic with Anne Dixon is Dissent, U.S. Government Insiders Speak Out Against the War in Iraq. You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm David Hazeltine of WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. Next, Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio interviews journalist Mark Perry about his surprising story in Foreign Policy magazine. There is evidently another group of dissenters within the upper echelon of the U.S. military, and they disagree with U.S. and Israeli policy on Hamas and Hezbollah.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
Roger Waters, We Shall Overcome, inspired by the Gaza Freedom Movement. We found it at GazaFreedomMarch.org. You can hear more of Ann Wright's Hartford talk at the WHUS website, whus.org. Turkey and 13 southeastern European countries are calling for an independent and internationally credible investigation into the Gaza flotilla deaths. The UN Human Rights Council and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon have set up international probes, and the Center for Constitutional Rights has filed 8 Freedom of Information Act requests about the U.S. government's knowledge of and actions in relation to the May 31st attack. Israel's own investigation, conducted by the military, found their use of live fire justified. The Israeli military also blaming faulty intelligence for what they've described as a lack of awareness that commando forces boarding the Turkish aid vessel Mavi Marmara would meet opposition. Writing for Foreign Policy magazine, journalist Mark Perry described the contents of a Pentagon Red Team report leaked to him by sources at the U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM. The report offers a new take on Hamas and Hezbollah, recommending they be mainstreamed.
The mission headed by General Dayton is designed to train the Palestinian security services in the West Bank. And General Dayton kind of pats himself on the back because he said that his efforts to do that have been praised by the Israelis and that he's doing it. We're training these security forces to assure the Israelis that they'll be safe from the Palestinians. That is to say, we're training Palestinian security services to provide security not for Palestinians but for Israelis. And the report does not mention explicitly General Dayton's mission, but it says that initiatives of this kind won't work. That if we're going to be training security services like the Palestinian Security Service, what should happen is we should focus on providing security for the Palestinians. That's why you have a Palestinian Security Service. All of this stands to reason. It makes perfect sense. But in Washington, it's really, and especially in Israel, it's quite a controversial claim.
Mark Perry's sources also criticized Israeli claims that ties between the Turkish passengers on the Mavi Marmara and the Muslim Brotherhood meant their group were terrorists working with militants in Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah.
The notion that Hamas, Hezbollah, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Al-Qaeda can be even put in the same sentence, as Danny Aiello, the deputy foreign minister, put it, that they are all working together, that there's somewhere a Politburo that coordinates their activities. That notion that Israel would have us buy, which they issued as a result of the Gaza flotilla incident, the Red Team explicitly denies.
I want to report this morning that the armada of hate and violence in support of Hamas terror organization was a premeditated and outrageous provocation.
Deputy Foreign Minister Daniel Alyan.
The organizers are well known for their ties to global jihad, Al-Qaeda, and Hamas. They have a history of arms smuggling and deadly terror.
There is no relationship between these groups. They do not act in concert. They are not the same. And that notion, which is accepted widely, I think, here in the United States, is simply nonsense. In fact, I know from my own experiences in the region, in talking to leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas, they hate Al-Qaeda. And they view Al-Qaeda as an enemy, and Al-Qaeda views them as an enemy. Al-Qaeda is actually designated for assassination leaders of Hezbollah and Hamas for their participation in democratic elections, which Al-Qaeda views as an American Zionist conspiracy. So this notion that's being peddled by the Israelis that, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Al-Qaeda are working together, are all the same group, there's no difference between them, is just nonsense, and it's absolutely explicitly denied by this Red Team CENTCOM intelligence report and by this, you know, by senior officers in the U.S. military.
Next, we asked Mark Perry why it was that the Israeli and U.S. governments failed to see Turkey's request for an apology as a golden opportunity to negotiate.
No, it's it'll be fascinating to see. I think, I mean, this is the one issue that the Obama administration right now is the most uncomfortable with, because we have very good, strong relations with Turkey. They're a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization of NATO, the 13th largest economy in the world. We've always had solid strategic, military, cultural relations with the country, always very friendly. We've always viewed them as a bridge to the Muslim world. And yet, at the same time, here's Israel in much the same position, but not a member of NATO, whom we back. And the Turks have made it very clear, if they don't get an apology from Israel, they'll cut off diplomatic relations with Israel, which would be catastrophic from our point of view. I just don't know what the Obama administration is going to do, because Israel's dug in its heels. They're not going to issue the apology. The situation is getting worse, and you can be sure that the Obama administration doesn't want to choose, would do anything in the world not to have to choose between, you know, friendship with Turkey and friendship with Israel. So I'm sure there are people in the administration working every minute of every day to try to paper over or solve or come up with a solution to this crisis. I don't think there's any question that the United States and Israel are moving further away in their views from the rest of the world. What the United States takes as shocking is accepted every day among European nations. And our relationship with Israel and our continuing defense of Israel has soured our relations with key European nations. Of course, obviously, key allies in the Middle East, and it just continues and continues and continues. So in following the policies that we have and attempting to marginalize and isolate groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, we've actually accomplished the opposite. We've isolated and marginalized ourselves, and isolated and marginalized ourselves even from our closest allies, who find it now puzzling that we continue to defend Israel even in the face of, you know, clear acts like the Gaza flotilla incident, where it seems obvious that we should be condemning them, the rest of the world does, and we will not do that.
The Red Team saying that if these two groups could be reconciled with Fatah, and in fact made part of the Palestinian Security Service, then that would remove Israel's argument for continued settlement building.
Yeah, that's right. That's the conclusion of the report. You know, it's amazing to me that the report points out quite accurately that Israel's argument about expansion of settlements and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, because they still control the borders, the air, and the sea around Gaza. You know, the Israeli argument always is that we can't leave now because it would make us vulnerable to terrorist attack. So, it's, you know, the fact that Israel is occupying the West Bank and Gaza has nothing to do, is not a fault of Israel, it's the result of terrorism. That's how cockeyed Israel's defense of itself has been. And the report takes that on, head on, and says the one way to deprive Israel of this argument is to remove this notion that these people are terrorists, and mainstream them. Bring the executive security force of Hamas into the mainstream, and what excuse would Israel have then for continued settlement building? You know, frankly, I think that this is an argument that probably Hamas would not accept. They'll say, we have good reason to be a part of the Palestinian Security Services because we're one society and we want to build one government. But, you know, Hamas leaders would likely say, listen, let's not fool ourselves. Israel is always going to find an excuse for occupying our country.
Each week there appear to be more announcements about Israeli settlement, construction, or plans for East Jerusalem.
And the report notes that Jerusalem is a flashpoint and that the Palestinian people are continually focused on the troubles in Jerusalem. I mean, the report was issued the 7th of May, but it took months to prepare. So, you know, it's been a flashpoint now for years. And rather than focusing on things that the United States would love the Palestinians to focus on, building a state, assuring Israeli security, acting nice at the negotiating table, in fact, the report notes that all of that should be pushed aside. Palestinian people are focused on what's happening in East Jerusalem. And what's happening in East Jerusalem is that they're being dispossessed of their homes and of their land again and again and again, despite this idea that somehow the Israelis have agreed to a settlement freeze. We can open the papers any day, and this is continuing. And that's at the center of the issue right now. And that's, in spite of the visit to Netanyahu and all the nice words, that is a flashpoint. I think it's going to remain a flashpoint.
Let's look at what could happen if the Obama administration were to take up the policy suggested between the lines of this Red Team report, written as we understand it to offer an alternative analysis. So the Obama administration calls for an independent investigation of the Mavi Marmara shootings. That investigation looks into the shootings, the arrests, the confiscation of materials, cameras, the massive number of ships used to board the 8 flotilla ships in international waters. That over with. They enter into negotiations of what used to be called land for peace. Israel halts settlements, and the occupation then has to be reconsidered and eventually withdrawn. Now, that's a whole lot of change. What about it? I know the Obama administration promised it. Do they have any interest in pursuing a policy that could lead there?
I think that what you've just outlined is probably the policy that needs to be followed and the one policy that will work, and it's also the least likely policy that we will follow. I think that the Obama administration has to come to the conclusion that Israel is not interested in a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They're not interested in following through on a peace process. They're not interested in sitting down with the Palestinian leadership and sorting through their problems. Their goal, it's always been their goal, is the destruction of the Palestinian national movement. That goal has been theirs from the very beginning. They have never wavered from it through 50 years of their country's history. And we have to start fooling ourselves that somehow, you know, Israel deep down is really interested in peace. The Israeli leadership, no matter what party, Labor, Likud, Kadima, it doesn't matter. They're not interested in a two-state solution. They never have been, and that's why we've never had it. And the sooner we can come to that conclusion, I think the better off we'll be in charting a policy, an American policy, that is likely to succeed instead of the one that we're following.
$30 billion in military aid from U.S. tax coffers is allocated for Israel for between 2009 and 2018. Just wondering, I mean, that's an awful lot of leverage. On the other hand, the Israelis are building their own weapons. They have what is now the equivalent of a Silicon Valley in Tel Aviv. Technically, they may be ahead of us in some ways. But so there is this military aid to be considered.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's amazing to me that we have a fully developed country, Israel, that receives the largest chunk of foreign aid of any country in the world. It's not Haiti. It's, you know, it's Israel. And it receives the largest single chunk of military aid of any other country in the world. It is, as you say, an opportunity for leverage, because while Israel does have its own defense industry, I think it would be very doubtful that they'd be able to defend themselves as adequately as they could without the United States. And, you know, we don't have to make this explicit. We don't have to say we're cutting off aid to Israel. But we can do what the first Bush administration did, which is make our aid to them contingent on their actions towards the Palestinians, the peace process, and following the strategy that we want them to follow in the Middle East.
Mark Perry is a military and political analyst and author of 8 books, including Partners in Command and the recently released Talking to Terrorists.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to retired Colonel Anne Wright, author of the book Dissent. She spoke in Hartford, Connecticut at an event sponsored by WHUS Radio. And Dory Smith of Talk Nation Radio interviewed journalist Mark Perry. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts, to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. I'm David Hasseltine, Public Affairs Director at WHUS Radio in Storrs, Connecticut. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.